Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Joseph Huff. I'm a public defender. My registration number is 34384. I represent the defendant, Mr. Harvey. As I notified the court about a week ago, I intend, because of the limited time, to only address issue one. If the court has any other questions about any other issues, though, I'd be happy to answer them. Let me start off by saying that in an ideal world, at all times, the trial court would maintain a certain judicial demeanor. And that judicial demeanor would entail not getting overly emotional, not having deep-seated feelings for one party or the other. That's in an ideal world, and I understand we don't live in that world, and it's unreasonable to ask a judge at all times to maintain meticulously that sort of detachment from the cases. With that said, I don't blame this judge for what he did. I don't blame him for being teary-eyed, getting choked up, crying, having to leave the bench. I don't even blame him for the statements he made against my client, such that he had victimized A.S. And I don't blame him for having deep-seated sympathy for A.S., the main witness against my client. What I blame him for, and where the error really occurred, was the fact that he failed to acknowledge that under these circumstances, he was simply too emotionally invested in this case to fairly sit in my client's case. It's his failure to recognize that his deep-seated feelings for the main witness against my client precluded him from being fair and impartial in this case.
Excuse me, Mr. Huff, you've mentioned that, and you mentioned in your briefs also, that you thought the judge's comments were directed toward your client's conduct. In other words, that the child witness was a victim and the mother was a victim of the defendant. I see nothing in the transcript to indicate that the court was indicating that they were victims of the defendant's conduct. In fact, it appears that what's being referenced is that the mother was a victim in her own childhood of domestic violence, and that there's no reference to who caused the little girl to stand with telephone books, etc.
I reread the transcripts, and I agree with you on that first point. The court was not saying, as I reread the transcript, that my client had victimized the co-defendant by murdering her child. He was clearly not saying that. He was, however, there was no dispute that it was my client that forced A.S. to stand in the corner with heavy phone books. If you look at the prosecution...
Was there any evidence that the co-defendant, the mother, had also done so?
I can't tell from reading the transcript that... Well, look back at the prosecution's motion where they tried to introduce 404B against my client. In that motion, they state that my client, and only my client, was the one that forced A.S. to stand in the corner and hold phone books as a punishment. And furthermore, during my client's trial, A.S. testified that that's what the defendant did to her. She never said her mother did that to her. But even if it was a joint punishment by both the co-defendant and the defendant, there's still ample evidence in the record that was undisputed that the court had a deep-seated sympathy and empathy for the main witness against my client. And like I said,
why does that disqualify him?
It doesn't disqualify him at sentencing, for instance, because judges often express those sorts of sympathies at sentencing.
Why does it disqualify him in this case? Why can't, just because he likes the little girl, why can't he be impartial enough to try the case? And why should we conclude as a matter of law that he was not impartial enough to do so, just because he made some sympathetic comments about her?
Because, like I said, it would be different if we were talking about this judge saying this after my client was convicted. The point is, my client still had the presumption of innocence at this point. And what you have is a judge saying, prosecutor, I am very sympathetic to your main ear and eye witness against the defendant. Now, that's a problem, in my opinion. Had he said this at sentencing after the presumption of innocence was gone, I wouldn't even be here. The problem is he had these feelings prior to my client's trial, while my client still had the presumption of innocence, and while the prosecution still had the burden of proving him guilty. And even if you set aside his feelings for AS, the main witness against my client, the fact that he said this was one of the worst cases he'd ever seen, the fact that he was teary-eyed, choked up, had to leave the bench, abbreviated his sentencing remarks, meant that these facts, this particular case, was too much for him. He was emotionally and personally invested in this case. And that's not what a trial judge should be doing.
Well, Mr. Huff, can I interrupt
yes, ma'am.
You? The fact that he expressed that, in what way do you see that it played out during the course of the trial?
It didn't, but I don't have to show any of that harm. It's structural error. In other words, I don't have to show that during the course of the trial he was biased somehow. All I have to show is that he was either there was a presumption of bias, which there clearly was, or there was actual bias. You don't have to show that that played out at trial.
Are you familiar with the, and I may be mispronouncing it, the Lidke or the Lidke case out of U.S. Supreme Court from 1994?
Yes, ma'am, I am.
Can you then explain to me how Lidke supports your position?
It supports my position because it says upon the completion of the evidence, the judge may express exceedingly ill will or disposed towards the defendant upon completion of the evidence. And that's my whole point here. The evidence had not been completed in my client's case. He was still presumed innocent, and what you have is a judge that's expressing deep-seated sympathy for the prosecution's main witness and saying that the main witness was victimized by my client before he's even gone to trial.
Well, you're taking one sentence out of the and doesn't it also talk about the fact that bias and prejudice as used in recusal connotes a favorable or unfavorable disposition or opinion that is somehow wrongful or inappropriate? And it also talks about how extreme that demonstration of bias needs to be in order to require a judge to recuse.
That may be the federal standard, but our courts have expressed something entirely different. And I'll read to you from People v. Barton. It says, either actual prejudice or its mere appearance. It doesn't say that there has to be dramatic prejudice. It doesn't even say there has to be actual prejudice. It just says, or its mere appearance. If the court is in any way interested or prejudiced with respect to the case, the parties, or counsel. He was interested and prejudiced with respect to the case and the parties because he favored the main witness against the defendant.
Well, isn't Barton distinguishable, though, because it talked about the actual personal connection that the judge had to the fire and the impact it had on him and the staff person with whom he was very close?
That's true, and I'm not saying these facts are exactly analogous to those in Barton. I'm saying the principles that the Colorado courts have applied have not been that there has to be overwhelming prejudice or that it even has to be actual. There just has to be the appearance of prejudice, the appearance of bias, where the impartiality might reasonably be questioned. That's People v. Shipper out of this court in 2005. Impartiality might reasonably be questioned. When a court breaks down and has to leave the bench, especially a judge that's been on the bench for 10, 20 years, has to break down because he's crying, because he's emotional, and expresses these deep-seated sympathies and admiration for a witness who's just about to testify against my client, to me, that means mere appearance is met, if not actual prejudice.
So is it your position that Lidke only applies to actual?
I don't know. I'm saying that if that's fine for the federal courts, and if they want to establish that standard, that's perfectly fine. Our courts have gone above and beyond that. apparently, because they said you don't have to show actual prejudice.
Well, that's not what Lightview says. It doesn't say you have to show actual prejudice.
Well, I understand. And my point would be this. Lightkey was coming from a place where the evidence had been completed. And again, at sentencing, if this court had done this, in my client's case, I would not be up here before you today. Because I don't think it would have been improper, and I don't think it was improper grounds for recusal. The point is that when these statements were made, when this judge made these emotional showings on the bench, my client still had the presumption of innocence. My client still had to be proved guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And this judge's partiality was in question as to that. Particularly if you consider that the main eye and ear witness was 2 months from that time going to take the witness stand in that very same courtroom and point the finger at my client. Now, how would any of us feel if we were on trial and the judge had said 2 months before our trial, prosecution, your main eye and ear witness is remarkable. I like her. She's one of the nicest people I've ever known. She's a sweetheart. What if we were sitting there and we heard the judge expressing those feelings toward the prosecution's main eye and ear witness? Wouldn't we feel like, boy, we might not be able to get a fair trial here. His partiality might reasonably be questioned. And a good analogy I thought of while preparing this case was, what if a juror during voir dire, a prospective juror, would have done the same thing? Would any of us consider that juror fair and impartial? If the juror had said, I'm familiar with these facts, and it's making me choked up, I'm teary-eyed, I have to go get a break, I think the main witness in this case is one of the nicest people I've ever known and a sweetheart. Would we allow that juror to serve? Absolutely not. There would be no question in our minds that that juror could not render a impartial verdict. And both sides would excuse that juror if they had done what this court did. Yes, ma'am.
And how about, let's say, a public defender who had the same thoughts about the witness? Would that be a requirement for that public defender to get off the case? Or would the public defender be able, depending on independent circumstances, be able to judge him or herself okay to handle the case, and properly so?
Being a former trial lawyer myself, I've had many clients that I hated and despised and thought that the victims were wonderful people. Now, did that make an ethical conflict for me? Absolutely not. But I'm not presiding over their case, and it didn't impair my job at all. But the standard is ethical conflict with regards to a trial lawyer getting off a case. It's not what it is when it applies to a court, which is their impartiality needs only be reasonably questioned. That's not the same standard that would apply to a trial lawyer removing himself from a case. And if there's no other questions at this time, I'd like to save my remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Jake Lofgren, registration number 40904, and I represent the FLE, the people of the state of Colorado. The people respectfully request that this court affirm the district court's judgment of conviction because the district court properly denied a motion to recuse the trial judge for two reasons. First, the motion was not timely filed, and second, the motion did not sufficiently state grounds requiring the trial court's recusal. Prior to trial, the defendant alleged that the district court judge should recuse himself for three reasons. At the co-defendant sentencing hearing, he became teary-eyed, choked up, and excused himself from the bench. He expressed concern for the victim's sister, who was a witness at his trial, and he had told the co-defendant that she too had been a victim. The district court properly found that these three statements were merely expressions of personal opinion developed after sitting through the co-defendant's entire trial, and that they did not warrant recusal because they did not establish bias or prejudice against the defendant.
Mr. Loughran, let me move you along just a little bit and ask you your position, whether you agree that all that's necessary is a mere appearance of bias, or if they have to show actual prejudice.
In this case, I would suggest that they have to show actual prejudice, and that's because of the untimeliness of the motion. About 2 weeks ago, this court released People v. Dobler, and in that case, this court said if a motion is not timely filed, and it is raised for the first time on appeal, or essentially raised for the first time on appeal, there must be a showing of actual prejudice, not merely the appearance of bias. And because, in this case, the defendant did not file his motion in a timely fashion, and in fact was well after the 10-day time bar, there must be a showing of actual bias. In this case, the defendant didn't file his motion until February 10, 2012, after the co-defendant's sentencing hearing. Even then, he waited 3 weeks after that hearing before he filed any motion. So even if we assume his 10-day time clock started at the co-defendant's sentencing hearing, he well exceeded the 10-day time bar even to that end.
But wasn't the basis,
Wasn't
the basis for his motion to recuse something that happened at the sentencing hearing, so he wouldn't have necessarily had any basis, he at least didn't articulate any, to move to recuse the judge prior to that time?
That's correct. And I guess the point I'm trying to make, Your Honor, is assuming that his basis was established at that February 10th hearing, he had 10 days from that hearing to file a motion to recuse. In this case, he waited 21 days to file that motion, despite the fact that all of the grounds he needed and all of the grounds he alleged in his motion were established at that hearing. The two affidavits he supplied did not require beyond 10 days to complete, and to the extent that he argues he needed transcripts, the affidavits alone were sufficient. Nothing in the rule requires transcripts or that they be attached to a motion to support a motion to recuse.
Okay, but the trial court acted on it even though it was filed after the 10 days.
And that's correct. And even if it was timely filed in this case, the district court still properly denied the motion. In reviewing a motion, the court must assume all of the facts are true. And legally sufficient facts are those from which it can be assumed that the judge will, in all probability, prevent him from dealing fairly with the defendant. There must be some allegation sufficient in all probability to show bias or prejudice. Here, that standard simply wasn't met. And indeed, in Smith, the Colorado Supreme Court said that prejudice is a leaning towards one side of the question involved and must be distinguished from the sort of personal opinions that arise as a matter of course during a court's consideration of the case. That's exactly what we have here. The court had personal opinions that arise after sitting through the entire trial for the co-defendant, and those personal opinions were what established the basis for his sentencing of the co-defendant. Nothing he said at that sentencing hearing, any of the opinions he expressed, were beyond the realm of what was appropriate, given that he had sat through the trial, he had heard the evidence, and he was aware of the evidence when sentencing the co-defendant. Taking each of the three allegations apart, particularly the first one, that the judge became teary-eyed, choked up, and excused himself from the bench, defense counsel made quite an argument that showed an emotion on the part of the trial judge, and it probably did. But unfortunately, emotion alone is not enough. There is no case that says a judge becoming emotional at a co-defendant sentencing hearing is sufficient to show bias against the defendant. In fact, it in no way shows bias. It in no way relates to the defendant, in no way relates to his conduct or any prejudgment of guilt. As to the second concern, that he expressed that he found the victim's sister to be adorable and the nicest little girl, again, those statements don't show bias against the defendant in any way. They show an expression of opinion about a witness that he saw testify at the trial. And as to the third indication, as Judge Terry pointed out, that indication that the co-defendant had been a victim herself was unrelated to the facts of this case and cannot have been used to establish any bias or prejudgment of guilt against the defendant. To the extent the defendant makes that argument, coupling those three issues together, his entire assessment of prejudice relies on supposition and conjecture. And in Walker versus People, the Supreme Court said that suspicion, surmise, speculation, rationalization, conjecture, innuendo, and statements of mere conclusion are not enough to establish actual prejudice or an appearance of prejudice. the supposition that's reached here does not meet that standard. And then both Walker and Smith, this Colorado Supreme Court said that prejudice cannot be established by personal opinions of the judge. All we have here are some personal opinions. The judge became emotional, reflecting on the facts that he heard at the co-defendant's trial. He made a comment about his belief that the witness was very adorable. None of these opinions suggest that he had any prejudice or bias against the defendant. And finally, if we look at what was actually the basis of the motion here, it was a sentencing hearing in the co-defendant's case. The court at that sentencing hearing was required to effectuate the jury's verdict based on the evidence he heard at the co-defendant's trial. That's exactly what he was doing when he rendered his sentence in this case. He was reflecting the evidence that he heard and rendering that verdict, or in rendering that sentence. For all of those reasons, unless the court has further questions, I would ask this court to affirm the district court's judgment of conviction. Thank you.
Mr. Loughran repeatedly said that the judge's statements about AS, did not show a bias against the defendant. Well, I'm going to disagree with that. Mr. Loughran conveniently forgot to mention the fact that my client said she was especially victimized by having to hold phone books in a corner, which is the punishment that my client imposed upon her. I'm not making any sort of judgments as to the wisdom of my client's punishment methods, but the point is the prosecution agreed that my client had done that to the victim, to AS. AS testified that the defendant had done that to her and no one else, and the judge said she was especially victimized by my client's conduct because he's the only one that did that to her. And again, I want to emphasize, if you're sitting there and you're presumed innocent and the prosecution bears the burden of proving you guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, and 2 months before that, in the very same courtroom, the court expresses such sympathy for the prosecution's chief eyewitness, would you feel like you were going to get a fair trial? If the judge had thought that the facts were so egregious that it caused him to go off the bench, would you feel like you were getting a fair trial? And my answer is no. No reasonable person would.
I have a question before you leave.
Yes, sir.
Can you respond to the question that I had asked your counterpart? He responded that a mere appearance of bias is not available at this point, given the decision that came down 2 weeks ago.
Doebler stands in part for the proposition that the actual prejudice standard is applicable if it's being raised for the first time on appeal. There's no argument here that this was raised for the first time on appeal. There may be some debate about how timely or not, but I want to emphasize there were only 15 working days between the sentencing hearing and the time we filed the motion. That's just slightly over 2 weeks. Now, to do a competent job, we had to procure affidavits, we had to get the transcript, we had to do the research, we had to write the motion, and we had to file the motion. Now, this court knows that nothing gets done in 2 weeks around here, and so it's pretty remarkable that that attorney was able to get all of that done in 2 weeks. And furthermore, the court never said this was untimely. The court addressed it as if it was a given that that was not an issue. So I would say, on the whole, this is completely unlike Doebler because that was truly raised for the first time on appeal. This was not. And as far as untimeliness goes, yeah, it was beyond the 10-day rule, but of course it was because the issue didn't arise until sentencing. And when it did, it was filed 15 days after that. And considering all the work it took to put together that motion, I think that's entirely reasonable. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. And the opinion will issue in due course. Thank you.